Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
John and I met in a religion class in Oxford, England.
Actually, we were in a pub.
Okay, that's a minor detail. My point is, you've always thought of coaching as teaching, and you like to think deeply.
And you love sports. Heck, you're the one in your college's athletic hall of fame.
We're Team Shoup, and we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels.
Well, on this episode of Going Deep, we're going to be changing it up just a bit. I'm Matt Bush. I'm the news director for Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm also helping Coach Shoup and Reverend Shoup produce Going Deep. So today I'll be asking the questions and they'll be on the other side of the mic answering the questions. So Coach Shoup and Reverend Shoup, thanks so much for joining us on this on your own show.
Thank you.
Thanks
good
for
to be
having
here.
Us.
And I think we could start with this is why podcasting, why public radio? What attracted you to this sort of format to talk about the issues that you guys wanted to talk about?
Well, I fell in love with radio a long time ago. I grew up outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in a small town called Oakmont and listened to the Pittsburgh Pirates growing up.
I just want to point out, I also grew up outside of Pittsburgh. Neither of us sound like it, though.
Neither of us sound like it, but we're both big Pirates fans. And so I absolutely grew up listening to the radio and loving the radio. And then when I got into coaching in the NFL, I was trying to find something where I could stay in touch with the news while I was doing my work. And it wasn't until I was in the NFL at age 25 that I fell in love with NPR. And I can remember going into work super early at Rock Hill, South Carolina, and my first experience with NPR was Studs Terkel and Radio Reader. And I would break down film for hours upon hours while I was reading novels with Studs Terkel. And from that point forward, really, NPR has been a major, major part of my life. Is I did game plans in the morning and game plans late in the evening, morning edition. I'm so glad it comes on at 5. And I tell you, out in other time zones, it even comes on earlier, which works out, you know, sometimes in the coaching profession. And so I think I fell in love with the medium of radio. Absolutely have. And I've done a lot in terms of broadcasting and radio shows, and this just really felt like a good fit to me and something that feels really, really good to me.
Yeah, and we've been supporters of NPR in all the different communities we've lived in. It's a source of information and news and substantive commentary that we trust. And so we wanted our show, our podcast, to be in that same spirit, a trustworthy, substantive source of information, news, in-depth explorations of issues that matter. It felt like the right fit for us.
And to say this is sort of the second iteration of your show, because you did start this one, John, you were coaching at Purdue University. You started this out in Indiana, so this is almost becoming old hat for you, I want to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were very grateful that WBAA, the NPR station there on Purdue's campus, welcomed us to their studio. And, you know, I think it's getting easier because we enjoy it. I think it's a fun way to do something that we care about. And while we were there, we were really at a time where some issues that we really care about were kind of at a fevered pitch, like concussions, and sports justice. And we were hosting an event there at Purdue about justice in sports. And so we had fun with a lot of in-studio guests from around the country that had come for our event. And I think that really kind of got us even more excited about keeping it going.
I think so. I enjoyed doing it. I absolutely loved going into the studio there in West Lafayette. But it also helped me that first series that we did, and I think there were 10 shows in that, and I think there'll be close to 10 shows in this second series as well. I think we got better as we went along as well. And I think one of the important things is I started getting a little more courage to say things that I think needed to be said. Whether I think one of the important episodes that we did in that first series was on concussions, and well, there weren't many people in the football business saying some of the things that we were saying, and I think that was really important work to talk about, you know, concussions, CTE, long-term health for athletes, and also for issues on justice of due process for athletes. And I think we're doing important work, and I think we're continuing to do important work and interesting work here. I mean, it's really fun to dig into a topic, and I start seeing things through a new lens that I'm like, well, nuts, I never thought of it that way before, but this is pretty doggone interesting. Let's dig deeper.
You said it took you a while to get to be more courageous in speaking about these things. Is that sort of like the culture of being a football coach, is to not rock the boat about these sorts of things?
Yes.
Very much. Very much so. When I was at the University of North Carolina, I got fired from my job at the University of North Carolina when our head football coach, Butch Davis, got fired.
Well, a few months later.
Yeah, a few months later. But Marsha and I made a decision to advocate for all the players that we recruited and grew to love and made promises to while we were in Chapel Hill. And advocating for those players in terms of due process and justice really kind of put us on the outside looking in. And then when we went to Purdue, I took a year off of coaching, actually, after that at North Carolina, as Marsha and I continued to help so many of the players that we recruited. And after they all kind of got back on their feet after the NCAA, you know, after the university suspended them,
and all of them didn't get back on the
And team. All of them didn't, you're right. But after we did, you know, what we could, I was open to coaching again, but I was a changed person. And when we went up to West Lafayette, you know, I felt differently. And, you know, we in West Lafayette at Purdue University, we certainly still really fought for student athletes. We really fought to get their eligibility restored, some players that I thought were unfairly suspended. But where it really came to a head was with the issue of concussions. And, you know, I can remember being called in to the head football coach's office and being told, you know, this is a billion-dollar business. You need to quit trying to fight it. And some of those fights cost me my job at Purdue as well.
Yeah,
it does take some courage.
I think that actually your question about courage and kind of gaining courage, really it is the concussion issue that sort of was a pivot for us because, you know, at North Carolina, it was really about due process and racism and just the injustice of the kind of economic, you know, lack of equity and things like that. But it just so happened that at Purdue, there was this amazing concussion study. And four of John's players got really bad concussions. And we, through NPR, met these engineers at Purdue. And they became friends of ours. And once we heard about what they were doing and what was possible, we thought, well, this is a win-win. And so I went to the athletic director and I said, let's get out in front. Let's have an event in which we, you know, talk about these issues. And he did not want to do that. So that was a point where we had a decision to make. And we made a decision that we were going to go forward with this event, with or without him. And I remember in that process of talking to the engineers and getting ready for our event, John, who'd spent 26 years at the highest levels of the game, didn't know basic facts about concussions. It's not talked about. And that struck me, the learning curve that John was on in that conversation was extreme, really. And I think that's really where we kind of both were like, okay, this is something that we won't do the same way if we're in the business. And maybe it's time for us to step out.
And a lot of this, you coached in the NFL before that, before you were in the NCAA, the last two places you were coaching. This was not really discussed in the NFL. This was really more you found at the NCAA level, you found these issues about concussions and about what you call sports justice that really came out in the NCAA more than the NFL?
Yes. And in fact, I can remember when we went to watch the movie Concussion with Will Smith, there were football clips of the Chicago Bears in that movie of games that I called
of when I was plays the that
of
he
plays
called.
That I called when I was the offensive coordinator of the Chicago Bears, and I don't remember ever having a discussion with anybody about concussions in 12 years that I coached in the NFL. And I think it's really interesting. You know, what Marcia said was it was WBAA, the NPR affiliate in West Lafayette, that invited us to this event with these two Purdue engineers. And what struck me with these two Purdue engineers who were doing work on not post-concussion protocol, but pre-concussive studies and micro-concussions and how you can prevent it. What struck me is talking to these two men, they both just looked at me and said, John, this is just a math problem, and it ain't even a hard one. And when he said to me, CTE is the only form of dementia that can be prevented, and it's an easy math problem that we can do, I thought to myself, this is a no-brainer. This is going to be the world's greatest recruiting tool. Everybody's going to want to come to Purdue. And frankly, I was naive. I mean, when Marcia went to the AD, that was a no-go. When our head coach caught wind of it, that was a no-go. And I thought it was going to be the greatest thing in the world. And so when the rubber kind of hit the road, as Marcia said, was that year, my last year there, we had four offensive players that had pretty doggone severe concussions. And the engineers aren't working with our football team at all. They're working with the local high school football teams, but not working with the university. I mean, they're 100 yards from our football offices, dying to work with us. And a mother called me of a young man that I recruited. A mother called me, and his son had a very bad concussion. Got hit
knocked
so
out.
Hard, knocked out. And she said, are you doing everything that you can for my son? You know, she didn't call the AD. She didn't call the head coach. She called the person who sat in her living room and promised her, you know, I'm going to take care of her son. And she called me, and I said, no, we're not. Pretty much the end there.
And why weren't they wanting to work with us? I think you mentioned it's a $1 billion industry. So
right.
Is this a threat to the amount of money that football and high-level athletics bring into universities? It's billions of dollars.
It's an interesting question that we have explored and pursued with a lot of people that are deeply involved in this issue. Because one of the things that the Purdue engineers have is new helmet technology based on the automobile industry, because current helmets are not, they're not made to absorb impact. They're just made to prevent catastrophic injury. In other words, skull crushing. So, you know, players think, I've got this thing on my head and it's protecting my head. Well, it's actually just protecting your skull from being crushed, but you're still absorbing the impact of, you know, these constant blows. And so that we sort of pursued that question. That seems so simple. There's a new helmet technology. Why wouldn't anyone, why wouldn't they just be grabbing onto that? And people just have guesses, but here are the guesses. One is, if you take on new helmet technology, you're admitting that the helmets you got weren't the best. Then you've opened yourself up to liability. So that's one guess. The other is that there's just such a cabal between, you know, the kind of sports, what's the word I'm looking for? Equipment industry, universities, the NCAA, the NFL, and TV, that this is not an issue that makes people want to watch football. It's an issue that really makes football seem kind of awful. And so how do we contain that? We act like it's not that big of a deal. And so our best guess is that it's just a sort of entrenched part of the system, and admitting liability is not a risk they're willing to take. As a theologian, as somebody who's worked on issues of race, I happen to think it's much easier for the powers that be to think of disposable black and brown bodies and not care about those brains than it is to think of disposable white bodies. And the majority of the people affected by these injuries are people of color. I happen to think that's probably in the mix as well.
Can you watch football still?
I can't. I really barely can watch it. I mean, our son is punting this year. You know, he's a senior in high school. We've made it all these years without him playing football, and he's punting this year. So I know I'm going to go watch him punt. But it is hard for me to watch football. I think almost every hit, I just grimace. That I feel like I can't unsee what I've seen. I can't unhear what I've heard. And it really has taken a lot of the enjoyment out of it for me. I don't know about you.
It is hard to watch on many levels. You know, presently I'm helping coach at a local high school football team where I also teach. And I view my role, or I view part of my role as watching how we practice, trying to help coaches and trying to help players to learn how to practice in a safe way. I want to be clear. I love football. I don't want the game to go away. I think there's a way that can the technology that these engineers have can save the game of football. You know, if I can I say kind of what the technology is? Because I think this is fascinating. The engineers at Purdue, Tom Talavich and Eric Nauman, they focus on pre-concussive. Their work is on pre-concussive issues. So much of the work nowadays is on the protocol. Once you have a concussion, you got to go into a protocol to before you get back to playing. which I think is important work. But what these men have done is they put monitors in your mouthpiece and in your helmet. And say a concussion is 212. If the boiling point of water is 212, say that's your concussion. Well, these guys can tell you throughout the week or throughout a game, this guy's approaching that boiling point. Hey, he's at a 190 right now. You better back him down a little bit, because once you get to 212, you can't unring the bell, you know? And so it's just like a pulled muscle. You know, if our trainer were to say to me, hey, your wide receiver has a tight hamstring, so don't run him on any deep routes on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday in practice if you want him to play over the weekend. That makes sense. That makes sense to everybody. Well, these guys have the ability to say, he's approaching that boiling point. We can see it. You need to back off on contact if you want him this week. Because once that bell is rung, it can't be unrung. To me, this is a no-brainer. To me, I'm wondering why everybody in the world isn't using this technology. And that's hard for me to understand. So what I try to do now is make sure the way we tackle, the way we practice, the way we do things are in ways that are safer. It's not the mid-90s anymore. We know the difference. You know, when I grew up in high school, we weren't allowed to drink water. Well, everybody knows that's stupid now. And everybody knows they're not knowing about concussions and brain trauma is no longer an excuse. It's not.
Yeah.
And I think to ask you to go a little further on that, you were talking about in practices. Is there a way in football that you can go through a whole week of practice without contact and then play Saturday or Sunday, your game that week, with contact? Because I remember reading, and know you have, about a lot of the NFL players who have been studied in these CTE studies. And in particular, I remember a story of a teammate of Junior Seau's who was an NFL Hall of Famer, had very bad CTE after in his post-career, and then eventually committed suicide, that he remembers one particular practice incident where Junior Seau was concussed. Can you have non-contact practices all week and still be able to play on Saturday?
The NFL does, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can. There's no doubt. You need to learn how to do it. You need to teach people how to do it. I do think you need to teach defenders how to fit on tackles. I do think that you need to teach offensive linemen how to fit on blocks and stuff like that. But once the season's going, the problem with the concussions, a bigger problem than just the one mega hit that you see on SportsCenter, the bigger problem is the cumulative effect of offensive linemen 100, 200, 300 times a day on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday in practice banging heads against one another. So what do? You never practice without foam shield, you know? So a lot of teams, you know, I've been a part of teams that practice without helmets. If you don't have a helmet, you're not going to fit your face in there. One of the shows that we did for our series here in Blue Ridge, with Blue Ridge Public Radio, is on the sport of rugby. And we talk a lot about the differences between rugby and American football, and how a lot of football coaches now are trying to investigate the sport of rugby, because I'm here to tell our listeners it's infinitely safer than the game of American football, and it's not even close. And our son is a high-level rugby player, so we do have experience with rugby.
Can I just say one other thing about the concussion piece? Number one, the NFL, the policies in the NFL around no contact practices and stuff are in place because there's a players' union.
Yes.
Period. The end. That's it.
And it's not even a particularly strong players' union compared to other professional sports.
But
right.
They have
but they've got that. And the other thing is, the whole way that this knowledge came even to consciousness for these engineers is when they first fitted the high school players for the sensors, and the season started, and it just so happened that, like, there were just no big hits. There were no concussions. And it was several weeks into the study, and they're like, what are we going to do? We're not getting any hits, because they were thinking, we'll do an MRI scan when someone gets a concussion. So just for kicks, to have something to do, they did MRI scans on people, kids, who were not having any symptoms of concussions. And they were shocked to see concussive-like brain scans in these kids that had no show of any kind of symptom. And so that opened this whole world of microconcussions. And what they realized in that is that by the time you have a concussion and you're experiencing things like loss of consciousness, dizziness, headaches, nausea, excessive sweating, or whatever you've got, it's too late. You've damaged your brain. But before that, your brain is getting closer and closer to a place where that one tap is going to put it over the edge. You don't have to get a big hit. And that to me, that knowledge, if you have that knowledge and you don't do anything about it, it feels like the worst kind of, I don't even know what the word is, of just kind of malintent for a human being's well-being. That was the piece that just kind of put me over of like, this changes everything. This changes our whole understanding. It's not about the big hits. And we have to talk about that more. We have to get that out there.
And to go back on something you said before that about how the NFL has a players union, well, the NCAA, Northwestern, tried to.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a union in the NCAA, however that might be able to be constructed, even if it wasn't called a union, do you think a lot of this would go away?
I think two things would happen. One, I think players would get paid a fair wage.
And you have a show where you looked at this, where yes, the amount of money schools spend on other things while claiming they can't pay players, basically calling that a lie is what your show was doing.
Right, right. I think players would get a fairer wage. Right now they are paid with scholarships, but it's not a fair wage. I think that's one thing that would happen. And I think another thing that would happen is that this conversation about head injuries and long-term health care, because in the NFL, it's a business, and those guys are employees. And so, you know, they have health care coverage, and there's, you know, kind of NFL alumni ways of – still, the NFL isn't great on that issue, but – in college, when you're out of that institution, bye. You're done with us. We're done with you. And so I think a players' union would allow players to come together and say, we want long-term health care. And the third thing I think that would happen is that I think players would start to negotiate before they sign that letter of intent. I think they would understand themselves more as a commodity, like NFL players do. They know they're a commodity. They know what the deal is. These college players would also begin to understand themselves that way and understand how much they need an advocate and to advocate for themselves.
We'll keep this conversation going in the next episode of Going Deep, when the Shoops go further in discussing the inequities and struggles college athletes face. Thanks for listening. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure you like us on Facebook and follow the Shoops on Twitter at Shoops Going Deep.